To summarize those names that are given in Ezra chapter 2 of our study, that is the accounting by families, particularly by cities in Judah that they were going back to. So these are the captives that had been in Babylon and now had been released from that captivity. Not only authorized by Cyrus, who was now the ruler, the Persian, but had conquered Babylon. And so he authorized the return of all of the Jewish captives that were in Babylon. But not only authorized, also gave the charge that the temple would be rebuilt. And provided for materials and financing for that work. So that, as we read that part in chapter 1, God had prophesied, and it's very interesting as we have, we see in Isaiah chapters 44 through 46, Cyrus was called by name, and God foretold his name and the work that he was going to do, that he would be the one to send the captives back, and not by for profit or reward, meaning he wasn't going to be doing that out of the motive that somehow that was going to bring money to himself or the Persian Empire, but rather he was going to provide for that work to be done of rebuilding the temple, sending the captives back. All that was foretold. And very interestingly, approximately 200 years before Cyrus came along. So that's a very remarkable prophecy. And as we looked at that when we were studying chapter 1, we noted then how different that is from what we see men who profess to have direct inspiration from God and proclaim what they say is going to happen in the future. How often do men who are claiming that provide such detail with names, the specific works? I mean, usually when they try to do that, they try to make the whatever they're foretelling to be as vague as possible. then it's a lot harder to pin down and say, well, no, you really blew that one. But of course, as we know, ones who are claiming to be able to foretell the future today, they do not have that power. But this is an example of God doing what he says only he can do. And that was his point in Isaiah 46, that he and only he can declare the end from the beginning and then bring to pass what he has declared will happen. So God can say, here's what's going to happen in the future, and then God can make that happen. And that's what he did here. And Cyrus understood that. He understood his role being under God and being given that charge by God himself. So to have that understanding, obviously, he had to have been made familiar with what God had said about that. So he plainly stated that Jehovah was the one that had charged him to do that work. So he gave that decree and sent it throughout his kingdom. So now all the Jews everywhere are able to and have been encouraged to return. And what is the main work that they will have to do when they return? To rebuild the temple. That's the focus of the book of Ezra that we're studying now. But it has to begin with those captives returning to do that. So as we understand what the main work they would be doing, I mean, whose work was that to rebuild the temple? And how important was that under the Old Covenant, under the Jewish religion? I mean, that was central to their, to the authority that God had over them by that covenant that he had given to them. There was a location, a physical location that he had specified. And even in the when he gave the law to Moses. At that time, that location had not yet been specified, but he said, in the place that I declare, where my name will be, that's where the tabernacle was going to be situated, and that would be its permanent home. That tabernacle, of course, had the holy place and the most holy place, where the Ark of the Covenant was, between the cherubim, where the mercy seat was, that was vital for the observance of the Day of Atonement and the commandments God gave for that, when the high priest and he alone could go there only on that day to do the things that God had commanded for the Day of Atonement. And then all the Jews everywhere were commanded for the three feasts of the year that they had, the first one being the Passover, and then 7 weeks later, the Feast of Weeks, or also known as Pentecost, and then later in the year, the Feast of Tabernacles. But they were all to come to Jerusalem, to that place, later would be Jerusalem, and still was at this time. That's the significance of that. But the place that God would choose, and that's what he said in the Law of Moses. Well, the first place that he chose was which location, where the tabernacle was, after they entered the land of Canaan, conquered that under Joshua. Where was the tabernacle set up, and where did it remain from that point? Until the Philistines, when Eli's two wicked sons were priests, and they brought the Ark of the Covenant to try to give them victory over the Philistines when they were engaged in all of that wickedness, that Eli, the high priest, had not restrained them in and was rebuked for that. And God had foretold the destruction of the priesthood, of the high priesthood, and being in the house of Eli. But when did that happen, and where was the tabernacle at that time? Up until then, Shiloh. So Shiloh was that first place that God chose. That's where the tabernacle was. Well, then the tabernacle was destroyed. The Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant to their land for a few months until they were plagued and sent it back. But then it was in Kirjath Jear, first Beth Shemesh, and that's when 52,000 of the Israelites looked in there and were killed for looking in the ark. But then it was moved to Kirjath Jear and remained there throughout the remainder of the days of Samuel, the judge and prophet, throughout the entire reign of King Saul, until David became king of Israel. And then David, his first act after becoming king over all Israel was to drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. Jebus, as the Jebusites called it. It was their city. But that was a disobedience to God's commandments for all those years where the Jebusites were allowed to remain there. So David fixed that problem. That was number one. Made it the city of David. And then the next thing that David sought to do and received God's authorization through Nathan the prophet was to build a temple in that city. So God then chose Jerusalem, and Solomon was the one that built the temple, David having prepared all the materials and workmen and everything else, but Solomon built it. And then the temple was there all the way until the time when the Babylonians destroyed it. So now they've got to rebuild the temple. I mean, all those commandments, where the daily sacrifices were, the feast days, the Day of Atonement, all of that centered on that location and that physical building, the temple. So was that important work to rebuild the temple in that time? I mean, what more important work would there have been to do at this moment in time? I mean, we can see how important that was to David for the Ark of the Covenant not to have a place for several decades, the children of Israel, until David rectified that problem, or began to, until it finally was finished under Solomon when the temple was completed. But for many decades, the children of Israel, they couldn't follow those commandments of God because there was no building. I mean, there was no tabernacle, no temple. So there was no most holy place. The Ark of the Covenant wasn't in that place. That didn't exist for that time. I mean, the children of Israel had no place to go. And so there were a number of very important commandments for the nation that were not obeyed for a long time. Well, now they're back in that same situation here. There's no temple. They go back to Israel. I mean, how are they going to be able to observe all those commandments? I mean, this was absolutely crucial. So was this a work of man, or was this the work of the Lord for them to be involved in? I mean, this was the work of God, and this was the most important work that they could have possibly been doing. That being the case, when all of the Jews are given the opportunity to go back, how many should have been eager and willing to do that? If their minds were right, and if they had spiritually, if their priorities were as they should have been, then how many of the Jews would have gone back to the land of Israel that were physically capable of doing so? It should have been all of them. There's a reason why we have Ezra chapter 2, and even though it's 70 verses long, we think, well, that's a lot of names. When we get the number that he gives there, it's 49,717. Now, we're not told the full population of all the Jews that existed and that were in all those places now in the Persian Empire, but it was a whole lot more than 50,000. So the fact that those are the ones that chose to return, and also noteworthy, how long was the captivity in Babylon? 70 years. How many of these 50,000 that are going back were of an age where they would have memories of the land of Israel prior to the captivity and remembering the temple? And I mean, how old would one have to be at this point in time to have been in Israel, remembered that land, remembered the temple that had stood there before? And there were some, because when that foundation is laid, that's coming up very soon in our study, Lord willing, but there were some, and when they saw the foundation of the second temple built, it didn't match in its size. It did not match with what had stood there before, and the ones who had those memories, it gave them cause to weep. And we also see that in the book of Haggai at the same time. Yes. Yes.
From the beginning, to go back to make sure they were in the right relationship with God by building the altar and being the temple.
Yeah, because they start with the daily sacrifice. So they did, and that's a point that we want to cover. Appreciate that, because you got to do what you can do. And so they prioritized the works. So the first thing they did was build an altar and reinstituted the daily sacrifice. I mean, you're not going to wait and put that to the end in order to deal with something where you're going to be able to observe the feast three times in a year. I mean, they followed a way in which they could comply with God's commandments the most they could as soon as they could. So they started with that altar so they could resume the daily sacrifice, and then they progressed from there. So that's an important point that we'll hopefully be able to have the opportunity to delve into some more. But for those who were around that could see this foundation laid at the second temple and have memories of the first, I mean, how old would they have to be? I mean, a 70-year captivity plus whatever years. I mean, you're talking about people that are 80 in that neighborhood and above. You know, of these 50,000 roughly that go back there, how many, and we're not told, we don't have a breakdown by age, but would that have been the majority of these ones that go back, or would that have been a minority that would have been that old and physically capable of making that trip back to the land of Israel at that time? I mean, we understand that would be a few. So the majority of these 50,000 that go back, what is the land of Israel to them as far as any experience or memory? Total unknown, like Abraham. But when it was God's will for Abraham to go and leave all that he had ever known to go where God wanted him to go, what did he do? He went, because Abraham was following God, and what was best for the Lord was best for Abraham. This number should have been a whole lot bigger than 50,000. But it shows, at least for these, here were people, the majority, the vast majority of whom, what would have been their reason for going back? It's not because, oh, finally we get to go back home to a home they knew. This was, they were leaving all that they'd ever known as far as a dwelling place to go to some place they, most of them, had never been before. But what did they have to obviously understand about the situation? They were God's people. And we remember when God said those ones he was preserving in captivity, he was going to give them hearts to know him. And they would serve him. So this is the repentant people we can see that are going back. And their concern is doing what is the will of God. And what is best for the Lord is best for them. And these ones have their priorities right. And the Lord has singled them out, and there's a reason. There's a detail, the details that we have in all those names in chapter 2. It's significant. The Lord is naming all of these, and he's giving emphasis to, here are my people that were doing what was right here. Just like we have, on the other hand, as we know, we have, and we're going to see a big case of that at the end of the book of Nehemiah, when he goes through the roster of all the ones that had married those women from those other nations in contradiction to what God had commanded. And so we have, in that sense, sort of a hall of shame at the end of Nehemiah 13. But God does that. God preserves the names of certain ones that broke his commandments. We have lessons to learn from that, and there's a reason why their names are preserved. We don't want to be on that kind of list. But on the other hand, we have lists like these ones in Ezra 2, where God points out his faithful ones, the ones who were doing his will. And what does that mean to us? Well, we want to be like that. We want to be somebody the Lord looks at like that. That, okay, here's a servant of mine that loves me, that is going to follow me and do my will all the time, whatever the circumstance. And they're not going to put their own situation there. They're not going to put their own priorities ahead of mine. These are my people that are living to do for me to do my will. So we receive encouragement from that right there. There's a good purpose for that. So this, all those names, it's not just, well, why is that there? There's a good reason for that. And we want to be on that ultimate list. The one that really counts is going to count on Judgment Day. In the book of Revelation, what does he call it? The Lamb's what? Lamb's Book of Life. If our name is in it, when you read the end of Revelation 20, those whose names are, well, if their names are not found in that book, so we have chapter 20 and chapter 21 of Revelation that show us both sides. If your name's not found in that book, then they're going to have their part in the lake of fire. But if our name is in that book on that day of judgment, then we will be brought into that city four square, God's dwelling place in heaven. So God does take account of those who are serving him and those who are not. So we want to be have our name and ultimately in that book among those that are going to be able to be with God for eternity. But it starts by having our minds right to serve the Lord, to do his will, and not be doing our own will. Well, I don't know. I've never been over there. I'm not traveling all the way over to Israel. I've never been there. I don't know anything about that. I mean, that obviously there were quite a few people that were Jews that did not make this journey and were not therefore engaged in this great work that God had for them to do. We're also going to read in the book of Haggai some of these ones that go back. Unfortunately, even though they obviously had priorities right to go back and had in mind to do this work of God, they still started building their own houses first. And God had something to say about that. It's like, you're taking care of yourselves and leaving my house unbuilt. And so, he's going to rebuke them for that. So even when we have our mind set to do the Lord's will, if we're not watching everything we're doing, we can still end up making some choices or maybe having our priorities not quite still where they need to be. So that's a constant work we have to be doing and examining ourselves and trying to make sure that at all times we really are doing what is best, number one, for the Lord, and not putting ourselves in that position. Couple of other points to wrap up from chapter 2 that we didn't get to cover with these ones. And he went through all these different cities of Judah and the ones that were going back there, how the number that were going back there. And it was very obvious as he went through that list, the numbers who were going back to those locations, they sure were not a full population of people for those locations that they were going back to. In that list there, some of the ones that we read about, there was a group that's mentioned frequently along with Solomon's servants, and we saw them mentioned here in Ezra chapter 2, beginning of verse 43, and there was quite a list, listing there, really from verses 43 down through 54, these ones that are the Nethinims. Now, who are they? We read that, and here's a group that's singled out as a separate, distinct group, and, there are quite a few that are mentioned, and their names given there. When I read that, I'm wondering, who are these? Who are the Nethinims, and where did they come from? That's not a name that we see up until now. This is a name. This is not a location. This isn't a place name, a geographical location. There wasn't a town of Nethinim, he's not talking about like the Nethinimites. No, these aren't people from a location of Nethinim. This is a descriptive term. The Nethinims there. Is a term. It means it's a Hebrew word that means the given ones. So when he says the Nethinims here, it's the given ones. So the given ones, he starts to name the children of Zahia and so forth. I'm not going to reread all those, you're welcome to do that. These are these given ones, he says, and we find mention of them in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah 16 times, which is pretty interesting. They're going to come up over and over again, actually, in this in the study of the book of Ezra, and then also in the book of Nehemiah. One thing, First Chronicles 9 and verse 2, that's the other mention of Nethinim. So I think I said we didn't see that until the book of Ezra. That's inaccurate. The first mention is actually First Chronicles chapter 9 and verse 2, when he said, "Now the first inhabitants that dwelt in their possessions in their cities were the Israelites, the priests, Levites, and the Nethinims." Which all of this is significant because when we're trying to understand who are the given ones, well, he keeps them in 1 Chronicles 9, verse 2, as well as in Ezra and Nehemiah. They're looked at as a separate and distinct group of people. They're separate and distinct from the Israelites, the priests, and the Levites. So are these people Hebrew? Are these Hebrews? Well, when he has the Israelites and then the priests and Levites, which we understand the priests and Levites, who they are and the reason why they're looked at distinctly, but these given ones are then also a part there. Well, the indication is they're not Hebrews. Their names are not Hebrew names that are given there, like we see in those verses in Ezra chapter 2. So it's really an interesting question about who these people are, what were their origins. We can see that they lived and worked together as a separate group. Now, one of the things, what was their main work? If we can just skip forward a little bit in Ezra to chapter 8, since we're reading about them in chapter 2. Ezra chapter 8 and verse 20 says, "Also of the Nethinims, whom David and the princes had appointed for the service of the Levites, 220 Nethinims, all of them were expressed by names." So they were the given ones. Well, what were they given to do? Well, it says there that David and the princes had appointed them for the service of the Levites. Well, we know the Levites' main work was to assist their brethren, who were fellow Levites, but the priests. Now, we know the priests, all priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests, correct? Who were the tribe of Levi? Among that tribe, who were the priests? Only the descendants of whom? Aaron, the first high priest, the brother of Moses. So the priests were the descendants of Aaron. Well, that was one family in all the tribe of Levi. Now, were there any other Levites at any point that objected to that, that felt like, well, we're Levites too? What makes you so special, Aaron? Because he's also mentioned in the New Testament a couple of times among those, don't be like that guy, Korah, who we read about in number 16. He was a Levite, but he didn't like the fact that not being of the descendants of Aaron, well, he couldn't be a priest, and none of his family could be priests. And so he challenged that authority. Well, and he said, "You take too much on yourselves," speaking to Moses and Aaron. But did Moses take his position as the leader of Israel, the judge, the one that God gave the law to? Did Moses take that upon himself? Did Aaron take it upon himself to be high priest and assume that authority? God placed that authority, gave them that authority. That was, they didn't take it upon themselves, it was given by God. And of course, it's the next chapter, number 17. What miracle did God do and then have it preserved in the Ark of the Covenant for a testimony forever to make sure that they never forgot? It was God had chosen Aaron. He made that Aaron's rod bud, and it bore almonds. And all the other tribes had the names of the tribes on there, but for Levi, he had Aaron's name. So he was specifically authorizing Aaron and his descendants and only them to be the priests in Israel. And what happened to Korah, by the way?
Earth swallowed him up.
So God made a very graphic point of that rebellion, that was a rebellion against the authority of God. But that shows the priests were only of the descendants of Aaron. The rest of the tribe of Levi, they had very important work to do that was in assistance to the priests. And that's why God said that he was the inheritance of that entire tribe. So they weren't given a specific land inheritance like the rest of the tribes of Israel. That's why when we look at the listing of the 12 tribes of Israel, who are the 12 tribes of Israel? It depends on how you're looking at it. Now, if we're looking at it strictly in terms of the descendants of Jacob, the actual 12 sons of Jacob, well, then that listing is going to include Joseph and Levi. But when we look at when the lot divided, the lots were given and divided the land of Canaan into the 12 divisions for the tribes of Israel, that listing is different slightly. Yes.
But also, they didn't have any dissensions among the leadership, because anytime there was any dissension, God pretty much handled it.
Yes. Yes. It took several times.
You would never see them step out of what God has
But as is human nature, did they learn that lesson the easy way or the hard way? They learned the hard way. Of course, we're different from that, aren't we? We need to be, but I think we can all look at ourselves and know we've had to learn quite a few things the hard way too, but that's our nature. But that lesson was taught. But that's what, and when the land inheritance was given, Levi wasn't given one. So how does it still add up to 12 if you subtract Levi? Well, who got two? The double portion of the inheritance that should have gone to, who was the firstborn? Reuben, but that was taken away from him because of the sin that he committed with his father's concubine. So that was then given to the house of Joseph. Manasseh and Ephraim, the two sons of Joseph, so they receive separate inheritances. Levi didn't get one. So it still adds up to 12 when you look at the land distribution. But there were cities scattered among all those tribes where the Levites lived to assist the people in their obedience to God's commandments. And then they helped the priests at the tabernacle and later the temple. So they had very important work to do. Now we're reading about these Nethinims, these given ones, and their work is an assistance to the Levites. So from that, what kind of jobs? The priests had their jobs that only they could do. Now the Levites had many, and there's a breakdown. Gershon, Kohath, and Merari were the three sons of Levi. And going back to the book of Numbers, Exodus and Numbers, there were specific jobs that each of those families of the Levites were given. They were given charge over certain things. So there were a lot of specific works that all those families in Levi had to do. There were still some of that work we can see was there were this group of people, the given ones, the Nethinims, that were assigned by David to help the Levites in their work. So what kind of jobs, without knowing the exact details of them, is the hierarchy of jobs from high to low? The Nethinims would have been doing which jobs? The ones on top or the ones? Yeah. I mean, there would have been a lot of, we could see that they would be doing a lot of what we would call kind of the menial work or physical labor that would have to be done to assist the Levites in their work. So we know those particular details, but that's as far as what God speaks about it. So that's as far as we can go with any certainty to say here's who they were, here's what they did. Now we might have a hint, and all we can do is look at this as a point of comparison and consider this possibility, because I'm not going to state this as a definite, because I can't say something that God doesn't say. But going back in Israel's history, was there any group of non-Hebrew people that were going to be among the Israelites that were going to have very menial or lowly tasks that they would have to perform in service to the Israelites? Well, there's one in Joshua chapter 9, the Gibeonites, if you remember those people. They're the ones that deceived Joshua and the elders of Israel when they put on those old rotten rags and had moldy bread and all that stuff, when they were giving the appearance that they had made a long journey to get to the children of Israel. We've heard about what God has done through you, and so make a league with us that you will not destroy us. And Joshua and the elders of the people did that. They were deceived. They believed their story. And then they made a covenant that they would not destroy those people. Problem, they were lying. They had not come from a long journey. They were Canaanites from Gibeon. At that point, Jericho had fallen. Israel had... And also Ai, Jericho and Ai, the first two cities of Canaan had fallen, and Gibeon was next door. So they very wisely or accurately deduced, we're next. And if Jericho couldn't stand before them, what did Gibeon think about their chances? They didn't think they had a chance. So they decided, well, instead of getting destroyed, let's go make a covenant. But what did God told the Israelites not to do with any of those people of Canaan? They weren't supposed to do that. So, and of course, in Joshua 9, it tells us one error that Joshua and the elders made there was they made that covenant without asking the Lord. Did God know that the Gibeonites were lying? Of course he did. And if they had said, gone to the Lord, if Joshua had said, Lord, these people are asking for us to make a league with them, what shall we do? What would have happened? I mean, God would have told them not to do it. They're from Gibeon. But that was that was the second time. This was a place where a situation where Joshua had to learn the hard way because he had actually made that same mistake prior to the first battle against Ai. When they went up, it was a small city, and they went up and he didn't even use all the army. Well, this is a tiny, we just whipped Jericho, so we don't need that many to go take out Ai, and they went and lost. And it was because Achan had taken of the accursed things from Jericho into the camp of Israel, and God was not with them when they had that sin in the camp, which they had to purge that out, which is what happened at the end of Joshua 7. Then they went back the second time, and Joshua saw counsel of the Lord. God told him exactly how to go face Ai, and Ai fell. But the first time, very obviously, he didn't ask the Lord, okay, shall we go up against Ai? They just did it and then found out the hard way that God wasn't with them at that moment. They had a problem, and it was Achan. But once that got situated, they took out Ai. But then he didn't ask the Lord about, before making that covenant with the Gibeonites in Joshua 9. Now, from that point, having been burned twice, do we ever read about Joshua not going to the Lord after that? No, not anymore. So he learned, but he got burned twice. But the second time was with the Gibeonites. But Joshua rebuked the Gibeonites for beguiling them. And then what was the outcome of that? Joshua chapter 9 let's go just read a couple of verses here. We'll actually start in verse 23 and see what became of them. Yes, they had a covenant with them that the Israelites could not destroy Gibeon. But Joshua 9, starting in verse 23, says, "Now therefore you're cursed, and there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." And they answered Joshua and said, "Because it is certainly told thy servants how that the Lord thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore we were sore afraid of our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now behold, we are in thine hands as it seemeth good and right unto thee to do unto us. Do." And so did he unto them and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, and they slew them not. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord, even unto this day, in the place which he should choose. Now it's kind of interesting that they were made, given these tasks, these menial and hard labor type jobs, but primarily for the service of the house of the Lord and for the altar. Is it possible that these given ones are descendants of those Gibeonites? I'm just mentioning that as a it's interesting how well it lines up, but I can't say for certain that that's their origin, but just want to mention that possibility, because when you look at Joshua 9, to me it's an interesting comparison. So if they're not, then you have another group of people that appear to be non-Hebrews that were doing basically the exact same things that the Gibeonites were given to do for the rest of their history. So I just wanted to present that as a point of comparison, as a possibility for the origin of the group of people that were the given ones. One other thing that I want to mention before we close this morning that we see in Ezra chapter 2 that is very significant that is brought up in verse 62. Actually, 61 and 62, when he says, "And of the children of the priests, the children of Harbiah, the children of Kaz, the children of Barzillai, which took a wife of the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and was called after their name, these sought their register among those that were reckoned by genealogy, but they were not found. Therefore were they, as polluted, put from the priesthood." Now, it's easy to just kind of read through that and just go on without giving much thought to it, maybe. But who is he talking about? The subject there, beginning of verse 61, these are which people? Children of the priests. Now we're talking about the priesthood. Okay, well, did the Jews keep meticulous genealogical records? They did. And we can see the significance of that and how that was used here. Now, they hadn't been in the captivity that long where, I mean, how many of these people, and he's talking about who they are, did they know who their father and their grandfather was? I mean, more than likely, they weren't orphans, it didn't appear to be. I mean, they're identified by their families, but just saying, "No, my dad, I know my father, I know who my grandfather was saying it sufficient. What determined whether they could be accepted as a priest? Not by what they claimed, not even by what they knew in their memories. What did it come down to? What could be proven by the genealogy? Now, is it evident that with all that was going on around the time of when the Babylonians came and Jerusalem was besieged and then they're carried away into captivity? I mean, we can certainly see that much of the records were preserved, but is it evident that some of the records were not? That there were some who couldn't now prove who they really were and knew who they were? But what did it come down to? To be able to function as a priest, what did they have to do? They had to be able to prove by the genealogical record that they were descendants of Aaron. Because otherwise, what might happen? What if somebody's memory or claim is a little faulty? What would be the possible outcome if you had somebody serving as a priest and somebody vowed, "Well, yeah, I know who his father was or grandfather. He's legit." But what could end up happening? You could have somebody serving in the priesthood who was not a descendant of Aaron. So there was only one way to guarantee with 100% certainty that you would not have someone who was not authorized to function as a priest from doing that. What was the one way that could be prevented? You had to have the records and prove it by the records. Now, does that say anything about God's authority when he said, "These are the only ones who could be priests, descendants of Aaron"? I mean, what kind of games could be played with God's authorization of that? Well, of course, we saw what he did with an outright rebel, Korah. But what about people who were, from all accounts, from everything we can see, they're not trying to do something out of line here. But it still shows when God authorized something, it had to be that way. And if it couldn't be proven that it was being done God's way, then nope, you can't do it. I mean, that's a lesson about the authority of God. Furthermore, it also has some pertinence, even to our present time. There is a very prominent false doctrine called premillennialism that's really in, I don't know of a denomination that is not infected with it. And also, sadly, we have brethren that are infected with it. It's just that widespread. Premillennialism, and I know I've brought this up many times, but pre means before. A millennial is 1,000 years. So what that says is that right now they claim we're living in the time before the thousand-year earthly reign of Christ that they say will be instituted when Jesus comes back, and that he's going to reign on this earth in Jerusalem as king, as an earthly king for 1,000 years. And they have a whole bunch of other things that go along with that. We mentioned that when we were studying, you remember in Jeremiah 22, that prophecy he made about Jeconiah, Jehoiachin, the king who was taken over to Babylon as a captive. And what did God specify about his descendants, his seed? That none would prosper reigning from Judah anymore. So it didn't say that there were not going to be any heirs to the throne of David that would ever reign as king, because that's what Jesus is doing. He's the rightful heir to David's throne, and he's sitting on David's throne now, but he's not reigning in Judea, in Jerusalem, and nor will he at any point, else that prophecy also would be shown to be false. He's not reigning over a physical kingdom, but over a spiritual kingdom, his church, and he's reigning at the right hand of God in heaven. So that's the kingdom of Christ, and that's his reign now. The entire doctrine of premillennialism is false on everything it's based on, but one of the other tenets of that doctrine is that they say when the time is right, and by the way, they say that the reason Jesus didn't, when he came the first time, didn't already do that was because they said the Jews rejected him as being a king. They weren't ready for it. And so then they say he set the church up as a temporary thing until he can come back and reign as. But 1,000 years, is that eternal or temporary? People use a number like that. From our perspective, we think that's a long time. But what is 1,000 years to the Lord? I mean, That's a day. What kind of a kingdom is that? Then what? No, Jesus came to be an eternal king, reigning over an eternal kingdom, which he's doing. But the church was not set up to be a temporary organization. It was set up to. It is that eternal kingdom, and the gates of Hades, the death, is not going to prevail against it. So it is eternal. But furthermore. By the way, if you read in John 6, who was the one that rejected the idea of Jesus being an earthly king after he fed the 5,000? They came to try to force him to be a king, and who's the one that that left and refused that? It was Jesus that refused that, not the Jews. So that's all back. But there's so many scriptures that are violated by that entire doctrine and everything that's involved in it. But another one is that part of that doctrine says that now the Jews are going to be ready this time. And when they supposedly are, the way that that's going to be seen, when that kingdom is going to be ushered in, you're going to have the temple rebuilt in Jerusalem. That's why a lot of the so-called evangelicals are big into giving Israel, because of it's based in premillennialism. It's based in a false doctrine. But and the Israel that's over there today, I mean, it's a country, but it's not the biblical Israel of the that we read about in Scripture. But in any event, if you're going to have the temple rebuilt and you're going to have all of that functioning and you're going to have the old covenant reinstituted, who's going to be priest? Where are the records now? I mean, if there were a few missing records then, as we read about in Ezra, what about now? How could they possibly have a priest? Who could prove today that they were descended from Aaron? They can't. So just by that alone, without all the other things I mentioned, and there's much more I didn't, but just from this alone, you can read this scripture in Ezra chapter 2 and see how God dealt with the priesthood when it couldn't be proven by genealogy, by record, from Aaron all the way down. If there were gaps, if there wasn't something that could prove all the way that, yes, you are a descendant of Aaron, you couldn't be a priest. But how can you possibly have a priesthood again? So there's never going to be a reinstitution of the Old Testament Israel. There's not going to be another temple with a functioning priesthood. It's impossible. God's made it that way because that's not his intention, and that's not going to happen. So that was one little kind of a side point that I wanted to bring up when we read that. But it does speak concerning the authority of God and how that can't be trifled with in any way or any detail. When God authorizes something, it has to be that way. And we can't just make claims about things. We have to make sure that it is so right according to what God said, and that's an example of it. All right, out of time there. So Lord willing, we'll start chapter 3 next Lord's Day. I appreciate some good comments this morning. We'll go ahead and close in prayer as...